Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 12. The Turn. When playing a weekend round of golf, the turn is a very important part of the game. It is the break taken halfway through the round, where you finish the front nine and are getting ready to start the back. There are usually refreshments available, and if you're not playing on a forest preserve course, alcohol may be involved. During this break, the score for the first nine holes is tallied and entered on the scorecard. At this point, you can have several outlooks on the rest of the game, the most common being time for a fresh start. This position is usually adopted as a result of making stupid mistakes on the first half of the course. A 6 that should have been a 5, a 12-inch putt that shouldn't have been missed. None of those mistakes will happen on the back nine, you tell yourself. Less often, you're playing well, a few strokes behind your best score. And since you always do better on the back nine, there's hope for the entire round. Today, Scott was stuck. He couldn't hope to do better than he already had been doing. Even a bad back nine would be his best round ever. He could bogey every hole and still be under his best score. If he could keep making pars, maybe a few more birdies, he might even come close to a 60. He looked at the clock above the lunch counter and stared at his empty plate. 2 hours to wait. Jerry and Pete had already started the rest of their round and were continuing to put up pars and bogeys on the giant scoreboard. The last few threesomes were keeping to the expectations of an excellent round. The leader among them, Andrew Patterson, with a 2-under par after 3 holes, a score that matched Scott's at that point. As Scott looked around the clubhouse, it became apparent that the place was getting pretty crowded. A glance at the parking lot revealed cars parked along the driveway and even out onto Central Avenue as the lot filled up. He suddenly realized they were there because of him. His piece on USA Sports had garnered attention, and many people were not going to be content with watching the conclusion to his round on a 25-inch television. They would want to say they were there when. "What should we do?" Paul asked. "Another hot dog?" "Maybe later," answered Scott. "Let's get some air." "Dig it," Paul said. Scott pulled his cap down over his eyes. He didn't want to be recognized from his television appearance and felt a little foolish thinking he might. But the girl who sold him his lunch did. God, what would Sarah think of that? "Where should we go?" Paul asked as they exited the dining area to the outside. "Let's go check out 18. No one will be there yet," suggested Scott. They walked through the crowd. Most people were congregating around the scoreboard, some commenting that the scores for Hanover's last couple of holes weren't up. Others passed along the news that he was going off with the second-place golfer after everyone finished 9. "Assuming I stay in first place," Scott thought silently. The asphalt path was dry and crunchy with loose stones. They entered a green cavern formed by the overhanging tree limbs. The leaves were touched with a few hints of early fall color. They emerged into a secluded semicircle of trees surrounding the 18th green. Across the closely mowed grass, a dark, black, eerily still pond taunted Scott. Directly across the massive water hazard were the gold championship tees of the 18th hole. "Peaceful, isn't it?" interrupted a voice to their left. Ted Lang emerged from the shadows. "Getting crowded here," he commented.
"Just killing time," said Scott.
"Yeah, I heard you'll have to wait for Patterson to finish."
"You think he'll be leading everyone else?" asked Paul.
"Yes, but he won't top Scott's score. Very few golfers have when it comes to 9 holes. I think you've used up this corner of the universe's luck for the day."
"That's what I've been telling him," Paul agreed.
Scott punched Paul's arm and then raised his eyebrows, warning Paul not to return the punch. "Don't want to damage the prize fighter before the 10th round."
"I guess your idea about having a great game once every blue moon or so seems to be coming true for me."
"Your game today has nothing to do with me," Ted pointed out.
Scott looked confused. He remembered the tight shoelace and the philosophical discussion at the driving range.
"Then who?"
"You."
The confusion persisted.
"What, I just decided that today not only would I have par or better on every hole, but get my first hole-in-one as well?"
"Not exactly, but you're letting it happen. A lot of golfers, when they start doing well, try to overanalyze it. Try to concentrate on the things they're doing differently that allow them to get a little bit longer drive and that more accurate putt. But you're not good enough to let that happen."
"You got that right," said Paul, pulling back in anticipation of a second well-deserved punch in the arm.
Scott just settled for an angry glare and turned back to Ted.
"I guess you're right," he said after considering it for a moment.
"You're playing golf, Scott. You're a good golfer some of the time, average most of the time, and lousy occasionally."
"You got that," started Paul until he stopped himself and laughed.
"Well, it's true," he said.
Ted continued,
"Don't let the game play you. Don't think about what you've done in the past. Every hole, heck, every shot, is different from any shot you've ever played before. You can't play any better by looking at what you've done. You need to see what you have to do. Then do it."
"What if I can't?"
"Did you think that ball would go in the hole at 7?
"No."
"You'll always be surprised at what you can do when you don't approach it with the attitude that you can't do it. Don't let the past dictate what your limits are. There's always a little more room at the end of the bell curve, Scott. The probability will never hit 0, no matter how far out you go. It's an amazing quirk of statistics. Some things are statistically unlikely, but never, never impossible."
Ted looked out over the lake.
"I'll leave you boys alone. See you at 10. I'm kind of excited to see what happens myself."
"I hope I don't disappoint you."
"Just remember, you're not playing against Andrew Patterson or the tournament record. You're playing against what you're capable of. Play golf, and you'll do fine and not have a single regret."
Scott shook his hand.
"Thanks for the pep talk."
Ted smiled and shuffled off, clicking on a walkie-talkie hanging from his waist and slipping a set of Walkman headphones over his ears.
"Nice guy," commented Paul.
"Yeah," agreed Scott absently.
What a strange coincidence that Ted Lang was here when he and Paul arrived.
It was even odder that Ted not only had been at Scott's qualifying tournament, but was also there to help out at the driving range. It was like he was some sort of guardian angel, a Clarence, keeping Scott on track. He found Ted's presence reassuring and left it at that. He turned back to look over the small lake. Just 8 more holes and he'd be standing over there looking this way.
Not in his wildest imagination would Scott have been able to foresee what lay ahead for him then. He hadn't a clue. Sally squinted as she exited the Speedway gas station. She was folding a Chicago-area map back into its neat, compact form, and smiled broadly as she crossed the pump island back to her car. Sarah had remained in the front seat at Sally's insistence. Sally was concerned the gas fumes might affect Sarah's unborn child. Sarah fiddled with the radio, unsure where on the dial the sports stations were. She knew there were a couple in Chicago, but all she found was Spanish-language music stations and talk radio on the AM side, and rock, oldies, alternative, rap, and one classical station on the FM side. Sally pulled open the driver's side door. "I've got it. We're about 20 minutes away. Straight down LaGrange Road for another 5 miles, then east on 159th Street. You find anything about the tournament on the radio?" "I'm sure Scott would have been able to tune in the sports stations in a minute, but if they happened to be playing a commercial for hair regrowth formula or a tooth whitening service when I scanned it, I probably missed any sports stations." "Well, I'm sure we'll get there before it's all over. I can try to call Jason's office and get a message to him." "That's okay," Sarah said. "Let's just get there." "Good idea." Sally pulled out of the station and out onto a four-lane road. She glanced at Sarah, who had turned off the radio in frustration and was absently making small circles on her stomach with her hands. "I'm trying to convince Jason we need one of those soon," Sally said. "What?" muttered Sarah as she was brought out of her daydream. "A baby. Doesn't he want kids?" "He says he does, but doesn't think the time is right." "You can always find some excuse to put it off," added Sarah. "But you need to bite the bullet and do it. Once it becomes a reality, your whole outlook changes. It's no longer, will we make good parents, but I can't believe we're going to be parents. I'm afraid to push too hard, but if we wait too long, it may not be an option." Sarah smiled consolingly. Then her face grimaced with pain. "Yow," she remarked as her hands instinctively reached out to grab the edge of the dashboard. "What is it? Is it the baby? Is it coming?" asked Sally in a panic. Sarah waited to answer, breathing deeply and letting the cramping sensation in her belly dissipate before answering. "Just a contraction. I've been having little ones all morning. That one was out of the blue. Whew." "Should we go to the hospital?" asked Sally. "No, it's probably just false labor. Anna had the same thing with her kid. I'll be fine." "Are you sure?" Sarah started massaging her belly once again. The painful expression that had torn across her face was replaced by a glowing smile, just as quickly. Sally was jealous, but excited for Sarah. "Is being pregnant as wonderful as they say?" she asked. "Other than the backaches and peeing all the time, it's the most amazing thing I've ever experienced. I feel the baby twisting and turning and kicking and punching. It's hard to believe that at some point in the near future it'll be out here with me, rather than inside. It boggles my mind sometimes." "Do you have names picked out?" "Don't get me started," she fumed. "Scott seems to have a predilection for the strangest names possible, and is adamant that we agree rather than leaving it to me. How would you like a boy named Iggy, or Izzy, or Monty? Or a girl named Amber, or Bunny, or Cassandra?" Sally laughed. "I'm sure you'll come up with something soon." "Well, once this golf tournament is over, we'll have to sit down and think about it seriously." "He sounds like an interesting man, your husband," Sally said. "Interesting, strange, bizarre at times, but ultimately lovable and hopelessly addictive." "That's a strange description." "I suppose, but it fits him." "I can't wait to meet him," said Sally. "What's Jason like?" asked Sarah. "He's driven, like most people in his profession. But he's honest and ethical, two traits that perhaps don't help many people in his line of work to succeed." "They sound like the kind of traits you'd want in a father, though." "Yeah," Sally agreed, sighing. "Plus, he's cute as a bug." "I wasn't going to say anything," agreed Sarah. "That's okay. Covet my husband, why don't you?" joked Sally. I'm sure it's mostly the makeup and special camera lenses.
Sarah, I live with him. It ain't no special camera lens, lady.
They both laughed and Sally pulled over to the left turn lane at the stoplight. The green sign with white lettering said 159th Street. The traffic going east seemed a little heavier than that going west, and a mile down the road, they were bumper to bumper crawling.
You don't think this has anything to do with the tournament? Asked Sarah.
It must be an accident.
As they crept along for another mile, the flashing lights of a Cook County Sheriff's police car reflected off the hoods and roofs of the cars ahead. Traffic eventually stopped moving altogether. Sally noticed a uniformed sheriff's deputy approaching the car and rolled down her window. He bent over to speak to her.
We're diverting traffic around the area, ladies. Too many people trying to get to the golf course up ahead. Some guy is shooting a heck of a game and everyone wants to see it. They had to close it off and there's a huge gridlock of people trying to turn around to get out.
You mean we're not going to make it? Asked Sarah.
You're heading to the golf course? Asked the cop.
We're hoping to.
Golf fans?
No, not really.
Well, no one is getting there now. We'll probably have to let some television crews through, but I don't see that happening for at least an hour until we can get things cleared.
Scott is going to be disappointed I couldn't make it, said Sarah.
Scott? Asked the officer.
My husband, explained Sarah. He's playing today.
Scott Hanover? He asked.
Yes, Sarah answered, surprised.
You know him?
Well, they've been talking about it for the last hour on the score.
The score? Asked Sally.
You know, the sports station on the radio?
He thought for a moment.
Do you have some ID, ma'am? He asked Sarah.
Sarah pulled out her wallet and slipped out her driver's license.
Just wanted to make sure you weren't pulling a fast one on me.
My husband is covering the tournament for USA Sports, Sally explained.
Jason Bernard? Queried the officer,
his voice somewhat elevated in pitch. Sally produced her ID and the officer stood up and gazed at the situation. He grasped the shoulder mic to his radio.
Hank, I got a couple of ladies that need to get into George. Can we do it?
Why?
Hanover's wife, the officer explained.
Done,
came the answer.
Come on up. We'll use a snowplow if we have to.
Ladies, I'll pull my cruiser up and turn it around in the median here. You can then pull out and follow me. Stay close.
He turned and headed back down the line of cars to the police car.
Nice service, commented Sally. Scott will get a kick out of this. He'll get a bigger kick with you there.
I hope so. What if he's mad? What if I make him nervous or ruin his concentration?
I don't think that will happen,
Sally assured her.
I hope not.
Karen Blakely rubbed the back of her heel and nearly fell over. She had been hiking down the shoulder of 159th Street and thought maybe a tiny piece of gravel had worked its way into her shoe. She couldn't imagine what was holding up the traffic, and quickly realized she was going to have to walk if she was going to get back to the golf course. A police car several blocks ahead turned onto Central Avenue, escorting a station wagon south. Her own car was three blocks back, parked in a Target parking lot. The map showed she had a mile and a half walk to the golf course, and there were no sidewalks along the busy street. The grass edging the shoulders sloped steeply into a damp drainage ditch. Trying to walk there had proved even more of a challenge than the gravel shoulder. She cursed as she watched the car disappear towards the golf course. How did they rate an escort past all this mess? She was grumpy and tired. There were $450 worth of traffic tickets in her purse, and Karen was starting to get worried she'd miss her chance to get her new client some airtime on USA Sports. She had not been able to follow the tournament for the last couple of hours. Between the traffic, crabby state troopers, a dead cell phone battery, and the 17 blisters forming on her feet, the great start to her day was deteriorating rapidly. She couldn't imagine it getting worse. She checked her watch and smirked as a couple of guys in a pickup whistled at her.
Want me to carry you, baby? One had shouted.
The thought that kept her going was the look that must have been on Jake Fisher's face
when he finally caught up to Patterson. It took her another couple of blocks to realize the traffic wasn't because of construction or an accident, but a tangle of cars trying to turn onto Central Avenue and get to the golf tournament, and even more trying to get out as they were apparently turned away. A policeman worked his way among the stopped cars. "Can I help you, ma'am?" he asked.
"I'm just trying to get to the tournament," she said. "What's with all this traffic?"
"Haven't you heard? Some guy is setting a record or something. Had a hole-in-one, I believe."
"Patterson? Is his name Patterson?"
"I don't think so."
"Andrew Patterson. He's the favorite to take it away today."
"Andrew," muttered the officer. "Doesn't sound right."
"Well, he's my client. I'm an agent. I have my credentials right here," she said, tapping the lapel of her jacket. Her hands touched rough fabric, not the smooth, cool plastic of her credential pass. Karen's eyes rolled up into her head as she remembered putting the pass in the glove compartment of her car as she left the parking lot earlier that morning. It was still locked in there.
I'm sure they can issue me a new pass when I get there. Please?" she begged.
She was on more stable ground with a male cop than the woman who had stopped her earlier. He was already letting his eyes stray to her chest rather than her face. She pulled her registered sports agent credentials from her wallet and showed them with a smile.
"I am who I say I am. I need to get there."
"Well, you still have to walk," he said.
"No problem."
She slipped off her heels and massaged what was left of the soles of her feet.
"A little dirt never scared me."
"Well, good luck to you and Mr. Patterson," the officer offered. Karen took a few steps and the gravel added another layer of discomfort to her blistered feet. She moved over to the grassy part of the shoulder and felt a little relief in the cool grass, despite the uneven and bumpy ground. It was going to be worth it. A big contract with Callaway, a nice cut for her, and a stepping stone to the pro golf tour. With her smile and looks, it wouldn't take long to find those golfers unhappy with their current representation, looking for a fresh, vivacious, hungry, new agent. A sharp pain stung her left leg. A stick from a stray bush had grabbed at her pantyhose and drew a thin line of blood across her skin. She dabbed at it with a tissue and cursed the golf fans that made this trek necessary.
"Next time," she thought, "I'm getting a helicopter."
Ellie took her tray of 3 hot dogs, a bag of chips, and the largest Pepsi they had to an empty table. She was glad to be rid of the camera equipment for a while and to get some calories into her system. It was shaping up to be a long day. A few more camera crews were on the way, and coverage would be pretty good, considering they were only planning on covering Hanover and whoever he was golfing with the last 9 holes. The equipment in the truck was transmitting all she had taped so far, and the producers back at the studio would have the fun of putting together the wrap-up show.
"This seat taken?" a woman asked.
Ellie looked up to see the woman's half-smile.
"No, please, sit down."
She watched as a woman slid into the seat, careful to watch her left leg that had a metal brace wrapped around the foot and presumably continued all the way up to her hip. Gina sat with practiced elegance on the plastic chair, setting her own tray down with an apple and banana on it, the healthiest food she could find here.
"I'm Gina Beck," she said.
"Ellie Burke." The two shook hands.
"I wish I could eat like that," commented Gina.
Ellie laughed.
"I'm sure it will catch up to me someday, probably after I have my first kid. I'll blow up to 200 pounds and stay there."
"Maybe I'm only a few steps behind that," commented Gina, patting her slightly bulging stomach.
"Nah, I should eat better anyways. Starting tomorrow."
They laughed again.
"Is your husband playing?" asked Gina.
"Oh, I'm not married," answered Ellie, holding up the fingers of her left hand. "I'm here covering the tournament for USA Sports."
"Oh, you're a sportscaster."
"Nah, behind the scenes. I'm a camera operator. I do some editing in the field, too, but I like catching great moments on tape. It can be fun."
"Are you the one who got Scott Hanover's hole-in-one?"
"That's me."
"So you'll be covering his back 9.
It should be exciting that they're going to have him wait to play with one of the better golfers.
It'll be Andrew Patterson, Ellie said. I don't think anyone else will be close.
If it wasn't for Scott Hanover, they say Andrew Patterson would walk away with the tournament, since his only serious competition, Joe Culkin, broke his wrist.
I heard about that, said Gina. Do you know him?
Met him this morning. Did you hear about the bet?
Bet?
Patterson bet Culkin $5,000 against the whole field that he would win.
Men, and there he goes.
Well, it will be an interesting final nine. Why don't you tag along with me, Gina? It'll be nice to have some female company in this testosterone fest.
That would be nice. I'm actually here with my boyfriend. He's an agent.
Sports agent?
Yes.
Don't tell me he's representing Andrew Patterson.
He was going to, but another agent beat Jake to him.
Sorry to hear that, said Ellie.
It's okay. He has his eye on someone else now.
Hanover? Asked Ellie.
Well, yes.
Wow, I'd like to meet your boyfriend, she said.
Finish your lunch, then we'll take a walk.
I'll need to do an update with Mr. Bernard soon, Ellie explained.
Then between updates, said Gina.
Who knows? Maybe Jason could do a little sidebar piece with your boyfriend.
I'm sure Jake wouldn't be opposed to that at all.
The scorekeeper updated Andrew Patterson's score to 3 under after the fifth hole. The next closest player was 2 under. Scott Hanover's score was the same at the fifth hole, and it looked like it was shaping up to be a duel between the favorite and the long shot. USA Sports was showing updates after every hole, with Jason Bernard standing near the scoreboard and Ellie transmitting the feed live, with 300 yards of cable linked to the microwave transmitter antenna atop the van roof in the parking lot. Despite the course now being closed, hundreds of cars still jammed 159th Street and Central Avenue. Some had portable TVs and just decided to camp out in the traffic jam and catch the action indirectly. Others walked to and lined the chain-link fence surrounding the golf course. A few braved the barbed tops of the 10-foot fences, but county cops pulled down most and others fell back bleeding. A few made it over. Some of them were escorted out by the larger red-jacketed officials from the tournament, but most blended in with the crowds of onlookers inside. A helicopter brought the second and third camera crews from USA Sports, along with more equipment. The golf course arranged for them to use the starters booth at the clubhouse to set up a control center. It was cramped, but would serve their needs. The engineers even set up monitors for the people out by the scoreboard to watch. Ellie and Jason went over the course map, picking camera locations on each hole and giving the cameramen and technician teams their series of locations. It would be tight, but if everyone followed the plan, it would work out. Ellie took the other two cameramen to the 9th hole, and they practiced following the inch-and-a-half diameter white ball as it flew from tee to fairway and fairway to green, then were putted into the hole. None of them had covered a golf tournament before, and both were as excited as Ellie to be a part of it.
"Where is Hanover?" Jason asked Ellie.
"Don't know. Haven't seen him for a while," she realized.
"I hope he didn't run off, scared with all this publicity."
"I doubt it, but I'm sure he's doing his best to avoid the crowds and autograph seekers. He doesn't need all that right now."
"Ellie, my dear," greeted a stocky, tall, well-dressed man clenching a cigar with his teeth.
"Uncle Harry," greeted Ellie with a hug.
"Mr. Bernard," grunted the old man.
He put out a paw and Jason tried not to wince from the strength of the grip.
"We spoke earlier. My Ellie here says you're the best man for this job. With what I've seen so far, I'd agree. That whole marathon turned into a nothing story, and we were the only sports or news outlet to have the foresight to have a crew out here. The officials have given us exclusive broadcast rights, and the other guys will have to live off the highlights we feed them. Good job, son," he said, clapping Jason hard on the back.
Jason looked at Ellie. Her eyes said it all. Harold Frisk was her uncle. Ellie smiled and winked.
"He's the best, Uncle Harry. Let me introduce you to some other friends."
"Listen, Bernard,"
Frisk said as Ellie began to drag him away. Next weekend, we'll have to put in 18 ourselves, eh?
He disappeared behind a bobbing red ponytail. Jason rubbed his hand and shrugged his shoulder to loosen up the effects of his first personal meeting with a USA sports executive.
Golf? With Frisk? How was he going to get out of that?
Well, hopefully Frisk would forget the invitation by Monday. Frisk's comments and confidence left Jason feeling a lot less upset about missing out on the marathon assignment. He was surprised that Ellie had presented him in such a good light, despite his comments to her earlier that morning. He pulled out his cell phone and called home. No answer. The sale, he remembered. He called Sally's cell phone and listened to it ring. At the same time Sally's phone rang in his ear, he heard another phone ringing behind him. Hi, sweetheart, her voice muttered into his free ear as she kissed it. I've got a surprise for you. Jason turned to see Sally and smiled and hugged her.
How did you get here? He asked.
I have a very influential friend, she explained. Jason watched as Sarah stepped into sight, very pregnant and smiling.
I don't get it.
This is Sarah Hanover, Sally introduced. Scott's wife.
You're kidding, he said, then corrected himself. You're not kidding, he realized. Mrs. Hanover, how very nice to meet you, he said, shaking her outstretched hand. Of course, Scott mentioned you were expecting a baby. I should have put two and two together. What a reporter I am.
Is he around? Sally asked.
No one has seen him for a while. Probably for the best. He's up for some pressure in an hour or so.
Well, I ran into Sarah at the rummage sale. She saw your report on the television and decided she needed to be here.
From what I've gathered about your husband when I interviewed him, I think he'd be extremely pleased to have you here.
We're going to look around, said Sally. Call me on my cell if you find him first.
Roger, said Jason.
He watched as the two women disappeared into the crowd. He immediately thought that hanging around Sarah Hanover all day was going to put the baby bug in her bonnet, and he was in for another round of let's have a baby talk tonight. Jason looked at the scoreboard. Patterson had parred number 6, still in a dead heat with Hanover, but number 7 was up. He had Ellie send one of the new cameramen to cover the hole just in case. They could also catch the 8th and 9th as well. It wouldn't hurt to have some extra footage on Patterson.
Your lucky day, said a high, too familiar voice. Jason turned and stared at Lucy Pendle.
Well, it depends on how you look at it, Lucy. If this Hanover hadn't come out of nowhere, I'd have maybe a 90-second spot tonight instead of 3 hours of weekend afternoon coverage. It's more of an opportunity than luck, I'd say.
Well, I'm sure you'll be helpful in the background coverage, suggested Pendle. I'm sure Keith is going to want his best face on this event, she said.
Her confidence oozed like toothpaste and seemed just as gritty.
Actually, interrupted Harold Frisk, who had returned with his niece, Bernard here is going to do the commentary today.
Lucy muttered and stammered a bit.
But, Mr. Frisk,
it's Jason's show, reiterated the top man. Ellie convinced me of that. Jason, you just tell Miss Pendle whatever you would like her to do, and I'm sure she'll do it.
Yes, sir, said Jason, smiling.
Frisk took another puff on his cigar, and the blue-gray smoke seemed to bond to Lucy's hair, possibly due to some reaction with her hairspray.
I'm going to check out the control booth they set up. Looks pretty good. That top official here, Bateman is the fellow. He's going to take me out on his cart once the real competition gets going later. Jason, let's have a good show. Good things coming up, boy. And don't let me forget that golf game next week.
Jason turned to Lucy. I think a nice sidebar piece on Patterson's putter might be nice. I heard it's jade or something. Want to work on that? Lucy turned on her heel, cell phone already speed dialing Keith Kelly. If he did answer, thought Jason, he'd likely give her the same orders. He wouldn't want to go against Frisk.
His equipment checks out okay, but his balls may be a problem, said Kenny Chase.
He was in the trailer that was acting as Carl Bateman's temporary office and headquarters for the tournament.
He rolled a golf ball over the desk.
You can get these printed up from half a dozen firms out of the back of any golf magazine.
Bateman picked up the duck logo ball and turned it over in his hand.
Is it regulation?
Right size. It performs well on the bounce test, but it doesn't have a brand logo. If I had to guess, I'd say it was a Top Flight. But without cutting one open, it's impossible to tell if there's something wonky.
Well, let's get his permission to check one.
Two problems. First of all, I don't have the equipment here to do an internal check of a ball. And second, if he happens to run out of balls while on the course and we destroyed one, it could be trouble. He has to finish the course with just the balls currently in his bag.
Then we will have to let him play it. Hopefully no one is going to make a big deal, said Bateman.
They will if he sets a record.
Then what do we do? Check it out quietly after he finishes?
There is another option, explained Chase. He picked the ball back up off Bateman's desk. Hanover lost a ball on number 8. It's in the water hazard. We could get a diver to look for it.
What, now?
The clubhouse has equipment. One of the greenskeepers likes to go ball hunting in his spare time.
What are the odds he'll find a ball?
Well, we know approximately where it went in from the news coverage.
I thought you didn't have any equipment to check it out.
I think I might be able to get access to the equipment I need nearby. It would certainly save a little time and possibly embarrassment later on. Look what happened with that kid in the marathon. They're saying now he swallowed a bunch of the ephedra capsules. Nearly killed himself in the process. Carl Bateman considered the idea and found no flaws. It certainly wouldn't hurt to protect themselves in this situation.
Let's do it. But keep it quiet. We don't need any bad publicity at this point. I'm going to be driving Harold Frisk around for the last 9, for God's sake. He'll freak if this turns out to be something like the marathon.
I'll do my best, said the other man, wondering how he would keep a scuba diver splashing in a water hazard quiet. Bateman looked Kenny Chase in the eye.
No illegal clubs? No extra clubs? No distance measuring devices? He asked.
No, sir. Just the balls.
Check it out, Kenny. Check it out.
Karen Blakely was ready to punch the red-jacketed man at the card table in the face.
I'm not walking back to my car for my credentials, she shouted for the 3rd time. Here is my ID. You have my name on that list. Just give me another badge, you moron.
As soon as she uttered the word, she knew she was in trouble.
I'm sorry, she apologized. I've had a bad morning. I was stuck in traffic earlier, got 3 tickets from a woman cop, had to park a mile and a half away, and a blister's bigger than my big toe on the bottom of my feet. I represent Andrew Patterson, and I need to be here.
I'll vouch for her.
Karen turned and was confused to see Jake Fisher's cheerful face.
Fisher, thanks, I guess.
Jake handed his credential pass to the man.
We work together. I'll make sure she doesn't cause any trouble.
I really shouldn't do it, said the man at the table.
Jake smiled.
I'd consider it a favor. Give me your address and I'll get you a couple of courtside seats for the next Bulls game from our agency.
Really?
Yep.
If you vouch for her, I guess. She is on the list.
Exactly, agreed Jake. No harm in bending the rules a little.
The man scribbled on a blank pass and handed it to Karen.
Hold on to this one, he warned.
Karen held back a snarl and forced a smile. She was more confused by the source of her aid.
Looks like you've had a tough morning, said Jake with some concern.
Then he added,
Any luck with Eric Gunther's family?
She froze in mid-stride, brushing away some debris from her dress.
You knew I was going to the marathon?
She thought for a moment.
No, she muttered mostly to herself. You couldn't have. Did you get...
She thought some more.
Why did April get that sudden revelation to send me out after that high school kid's family? It was you.
At that point, she was pretty sure the wild goose chase had been initiated by Jake Fisher and Jonathan Jones. She was ready to burst into anger when she realized the last laugh was hers.
But I had already signed Patterson when April called.
I'm sure you must have found that out already.
You wasted your time, Fisher.
You're not needed here now.
Why not go crawl back into the bottle you got out of this morning and leave this business to those of us still sharp enough to make things happen?
She continued to stomp up towards the scoreboard.
I could do that, agreed Jake. But I'd like to see how things turn out here. You've missed quite a bit while you were gone.
What are you talking about, Fisher? Didn't Patterson get hole-in-one or something?
Not Patterson. Hanover. Scott Hanover. Big deal. So some hacker gets a lucky shot.
He's had 29 lucky shots.
Well, maybe 10 or 12 were truly lucky. The rest just didn't hurt him.
What are you talking about?
Better call April, said Jake.
I will.
They reached the scoreboard.
There you go, she pointed out. Patterson is still in the lead.
Well, at least tied, she said as she compared the running list of scores under the sixth hole.
Just then, an old man started laying on tiles for the seventh hole. Patterson had bogeyed it. He was not alone in posting a four on that hole. More than half of the golfers had four or worse. But among the threes, fours, and fives, there was a single solitary one. Hanover S. Patterson was now solidly in second place, three strokes behind Hanover.
Well, pointed out Karen, I'm sure Patterson's skill will let him catch up. Skill will always win over luck, Fisher. Why do you care about Hanover anyway? She asked.
Then, turning slowly, she answered her own question.
You signed him, didn't you? You stupid drunk. Who's going to want to hire a hacker with a hole-in-one? You're a fool.
Jake smiled as Karen blasted her blather over him. He didn't care now that he didn't sign Patterson. Patterson was going to get what he deserved.
Well, we'll see how the shootout goes, he said.
Shootout?
That's what USA Sports is calling it. Hanover and Patterson, as long as Patterson keeps second place over the last two holes, are going head-to-head to finish off the tournament. It's going to be televised. Heck, they've already been showing highlights from Hanover's round already.
Highlights? How?
Some board camera woman followed his first nine and caught every shot. Pissed off her reporter until he realized he was sitting on the hottest story of the week, maybe the year. Unknown last-ranked golfer makes run for shot at Pro Tour.
It'll never happen, said Karen.
That hacker will blow three strokes on one hole once he's up against Patterson. There's no telling the damage nine holes will do. And all that television time for my client. How kind of USA Sports.
Good luck, said Jake as he left Karen cleaning the clods of wet grass and mud from under her shoes.
He smiled. He had expected maybe Patterson would par the hole, but a bogey?
Something must have gone wrong.
This might turn out to be a good day after all.
Eric Peters knew he had said the wrong thing almost as he was saying it.
This is the hole Hanover eagled,
he announced, as his boss took the outstretched club.
What did you say? Asked Patterson.
Eric swallowed hard and bit his lower lip.
Perhaps I should rephrase that, Eric.
Why are you talking?
Sorry, sir, apologized Eric.
Andrew's shot landed pin high, but to the left. Had the caddy distracted him? There was an indentation in the green between his ball and the hole, and a series of undulations that would test his green reading abilities. He had planned on parring this hole, but he had also planned on landing on the right side of the green near the back, downhill from the hole. He didn't look at Eric as he held out the club almost behind him. The other two golfers with him landed their shots in precisely the area Andrew had envisioned for himself. It wasn't the wind, he knew that. How had Hanover aced this one? It was impossible with the pin placement. He glanced at the boy with the leader's board held high and realized that even if he eked out a par, he would be two strokes behind Hanover.
two strokes. What was going on? The next closest golfer was two strokes behind Andrew. When Andrew had an unexpected birdie on six, he had felt buoyed and relieved. There is no way he could lose now. Andrew walked to the green, thinking. He thought about how golfers always played to their ability. An eagle on one hole would always be balanced out by a double bogey with an 18 handicap golfer, which was what Hanover was. Andrew would just keep playing his game, and Hanover would melt and fall. Hanover's score hadn't changed since he had finished the ninth hole, which was strange. He must be halfway through the back nine by now. He putted first, and the ball skipped over the rough fringe, rimmed the hole, and rolled down the hill to lie by the other two markers. Andrew couldn't believe it. He had been robbed of a second straight birdie, although he wasn't shooting for a birdie. He just wanted to be within 2 feet of the hole. Had he not rimmed the hole, he would have. As it was, the ball made it to the downslope of the green and just kept rolling. That was why he didn't try to make these miracle shots. They more often turned into disasters than miracles. Except for Hanover, he thought. His next putt stopped 3 inches past the hole, and a little to the right. He sank the next one for the bogey. He was now back to 3 under par. That was where he had expected to be in his game plan. Okay, an unplanned birdie was counteracted by an unplanned bogey. He'd par the last two, and by then, Hanover would have dropped a couple of strokes and he could get on with it. As they made their way to the 8th tee, he overheard one of the red-jacketed officials mention that Hanover had been pulled from the course. His group had gone on without him. Andrew wondered if he had been disqualified. Now, they would have taken his name down, wouldn't they? At the 8th tee, he studied the fairway, a severe dogleg right with a lateral water hazard under the crook of the knee. To the right of the tee, near some trees, a golf cart with an attached trailer was waiting. One man was sitting there wearing what appeared to be a black rubber suit. How odd, Andrew thought. The other two golfers in this group teed off first, both having parred the last hole. The second one drove his tee shot into the water. Now it was Andrew's turn again. Eric silently handed Andrew his 5-wood. Andrew knew there was no need to kill it on this hole when he planned his game. He looked at his caddy, whose head was down. Eric seemed to be trying to be as invisible as possible. Perhaps he had been too hard on Peters. Andrew didn't believe he was susceptible to the psychological pressures other golfers felt. He played his game. He counted on his consistency and skill. In the end, that was what would win it for him today. Why should this tournament be any different? Joe Culkin smiled to himself as he looked at the scoreboard. Hanover was 3 strokes ahead of Patterson after 7 holes, and had a birdie on 9 as well. He wiggled the fingers sticking out of the end of his cast. How he wished he were out there battling Patterson for this tournament. When he injured his arm, the first thought he had was that Patterson had won. He barely heard the doctors giving him instructions as they wrapped his wrist first with a thin, compressed cotton bandage and then some light gauze, followed by the moistened fiberglass cast material. He had felt the warmth of the cast through the bandages as it set, and was surprised by how light it ended up being. He wore the sling because in the process of breaking his wrist, he also sprained his shoulder. He had tested it this morning, and the pain was better, but still there. 4 ibuprofens later, it was gone. But he knew better than to push his body faster than it could handle. He thought back to 2 weeks earlier when he had watched Scott Hanover finish a distant third in the qualifying tournament. Hanover had been ecstatic with his finishing putt. He had jumped around like a kid, whooping and hollering and smiling. The smile had lasted until Hanover had seen Joe's wife hugging him as he received his first prize trophy. Scott Hanover had no one there to share the day with him, and Joe had felt sorry for him. "Mr. Culkin,
interrupted a woman's voice.
Hi, remember me from this morning?
Asked a perky redhead. Ellie, he smiled.
This is Jake Fisher and Gina Beck. Jake is now Scott Hanover's agent, and we were wondering if you'd seen him.
No, answered Joe. Then he asked, agent? He was beginning to feel a little less sorry for Hanover now.
Well, if he needs one, I have the first right of refusal, corrected Jake. If he pulls this off, though, it'll be a bigger deal than Patterson winning. I understand you're the reason Scott Hanover is playing today.
Guilty, answered Joe, lifting his casted arm slightly. Are you serious? Someone would want to use Scott Hanover as a spokesman? Does Patterson have an agent, too?
Yeah, a woman named Karen Blakely.
Wow, makes me mad I broke my arm.
Galloway is looking for a Cinderella, explained Jake. Someone not expected to move up to a pro tournament without a fairy godmother or something.
Galloway? Asked Joe.
They want Patterson, Gina said. At least they did this morning. Once the rest of the tournament gets played out on television this afternoon, who knows?
And Galloway isn't the only sponsor looking for a new face to sell products. Think about it, Mr. Culkin, continued Jake. Who wants to buy a ball that Tiger Woods can hit 350 yards when you can buy the ball that Scott Hanover used to get his hole-in-one and set a tournament record for 9 holes?
Well, the guy has earned whatever comes to him, agreed Joe. He's having a heck of a day, and I can't wait to see the rest of it.
If you see Scott, please let me know, Ellie said. She wrote her cell phone number down and handed it to Joe, who tucked it into his sling.
Will do.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek. If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries about a crime-solving veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.